6 then. Joke about segues in Sunday school, and you get no segue tonight, just 1 Kings 6, right? A house like no other is what we're taking a look at tonight. That's going to cover all of chapter 6. We'll probably be there at least the next 2 weeks. This building of the temple forms a very central part of the history of Israel because, distinct from most of the other nations on the earth, Israel was identified primarily by her God. Now, the other nations had their gods, but they were very quick to change them according to the whims of fortune. So if they were conquered by another nation, then they were very quick to just go ahead and adopt the worship of the god of the conquering country, and they were okay with that. Hence, most countries had a pantheon of gods that they worship, not just one. Israel was very unique in that. There were not too many other nations in the history of the world that worship one god. Most of them had many gods. There was a time in Egypt when one of the pharaohs reduced the worship of the Egyptian gods down to one, but it's not that they really only perceived of there being one god. It's just that that's the only one he wanted to worship at the time. And since he was pharaoh, he got to make that call for everybody else. But Israel was defined by her relationship with Jehovah God. He's the one that granted her the land. In technical sense, she didn't own the land. She couldn't possess it just by right of anything other than the fact that God gave it to her. And we still reference that today in terms of trying to solve the Middle East situation. That is her land. God granted that to her. That's not going to change, and God has never revoked that grant. Not even with her failure to live up to the covenant. He still promises that at some point he's going to regather her and place her back in that land. And when he does regather her, that's going to be an exciting time. But for now, during the church age, we don't see God primarily dealing with Israel. But throughout all the Old Testament, Israel is the focus of God's dealing with the world, and thus the building of a temple so that Israel can worship her God is an extremely integral part of her history because he defines her. He is her identity. People today trying to find their identity in all manner of things. And that's really what this the whole ruckus about, should we call it a boy or a girl, or don't reference any personal pronouns at all, because people are wrestling with how to identify themselves. And one thing that is... I'm kind of getting off on a sidetrack here, but I'll go ahead and say this. One of the things that's difficult about the sin of homosexuality is there's not too many other sins that people say, this is what defines me as a being, right? Most people don't run around, I'm a thief. That's who I am. It's just everything that I am. That sums up me. But with homosexuality, they do. That's who they are. That's how they define themselves, okay? And so that's why it's being made such a big issue out of. So, Eldon, you had your hand up. They were very big, and this will not completely define it definitively for you, but I can help you a little bit with that. God references, when he's talking about defining the land, from the brook of Egypt, which is down here. Okay, there's some little riverlets and things that flow down into Sinai, right about in this area, that separate off the boundaries of Egypt. So that comes down here, the brook of Egypt. But then he also references from the brook of Egypt all the way to the great river, the river Euphrates, which is up here. So we're talking about, if you kind of imagine tilting your head just a little bit and going from side to side. All right, so you're going from the brook of Egypt down here in the southwest all the way up to the river, the Euphrates River on the northeastern side. These are the boundaries of the land, and from the seacoast all the way into the desert. Now, he reserved most of this desert for other nomadic peoples, but he gave Israel from this boundary of the sea all the way into the desert. And he said, this is going to be your dominion. So that's roughly the land that he promised to give to the nation of Israel. Now, Israel now, yeah, I wish I could, I had some overlays and things. Israel now occupies, they have a little line that goes all the way down here to the tip of this Gulf of Aqaba. And up here, up the coast, over to the Sea of Galilee, kind of down here, and just this area. So the amount of land that they currently occupy is only a fraction of what God promised to give them. Only under Solomon did the nation ever get anywhere near occupying the total land that God gave them. And even under Solomon, most of this other land was still under the dominion of foreign kings, but Solomon ruled over them as a suzerain king. Remember, we talked about suzerain vassal treaties, where the suzerain is the chief king and the other kings are vassal states. So the Syrians up here, the Syro-Phoenicians here along the coast, even Absalom's fatherland was a small kingdom called Geshur, right over here on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. All of those kingdoms, Moab down here, Edom, those were all vassal states to Solomon. So Israel wasn't necessarily occupying all that land under Solomon, but they were sort of in charge of it, right? And so that's the boundaries that God said he would give them, and someday it will extend to that. Because you imagine, when God resurrects all the faithful people for the millennium, we're still dealing with a finite earth, aren't we? So they're going to need some space, all these faithful people. The rest of the world is going to be filled up with the likes of believing Gentiles that get saved during the tribulation and survive the tribulation period, and then whatever he's going to be doing with us as we administer the kingdom, I don't know, maybe he's going to give us just neat little plots of land, Gary, that we can cultivate fruit trees, and your mower sales are going to go through the roof, I think, because imagine trying to mow grass that grows like it's going to grow during the millennium.
Well, maybe, I don't think it's probably going
to
grow.
You don't think it'll grow? Or maybe we'll just be able to look at it and say, that's enough. Stop. Yep. Yeah, and the creation will obey us, and we can look at those apple trees and say, come on, bud, give me some fruit. Bugs, get off of there. See all this swarm of bugs fly away? Fly over there to the chicken pen. Thank you. Just congregate right there. Perfect. Stay there. Oh, it's going to be something to see, isn't it? So, okay. So Solomon's building this temple, and it is a key part of uniting the people as a nation. God gave them land, he gave them boundaries, he gave them a legal code by which they're to administer themselves, and he gave them a religion that they are to worship. Now, we have to make this caveat when we're studying Israelite history that just because the Old Covenant defined a certain way that they were supposed to do things didn't mean that Israel was always doing it that way. How many Christians always do it the way God tells us to? Nobody wants to claim that one? No, we don't, unfortunately. I mean, could we even say in larger Christendom, does the church always do it the way God told the church to do it? Not in the slightest. Israel was the same way. God gave her a very specific plan for how to administer her kingdom. She didn't do it that way. Even when we talk about worship, she was only supposed to worship in one place. And here at the time of Solomon, even David helped do this. We had two places of worship. We had the tabernacle split in two because David brought the ark up to Jerusalem. Right? And so some people are going to the tabernacle at Shiloh or Gibeon, and some people are going to the tabernacle that David had set up in Jerusalem. So we've got this little issues going on here. We're going to read in certain places where it says that people set up high places on every high hill and under every green tree. And they worshiped Jehovah there, and they weren't supposed to. In fact, I think we read that here just a little bit ago. They weren't supposed to worship at those places. They were only supposed to worship at the tabernacle and then later at the temple, but they did. So oftentimes when you're studying history, you have to allow for this dichotomy of what, here's the ideal of what should be, here's what actually was. So A lot of times when people study archaeology, I think this is the reason we come up with problems, because we'll say, look, archaeology doesn't reflect what the Bible describes. Well, of course it doesn't, because they weren't doing it the way the Bible told them to. That's why God kicked them out of the land. Eventually, they weren't doing it the way they were supposed to. But Solomon is trying to, because of the promises of God to David, and because of the promise of God to Solomon, he's building this temple to fulfill these promises. And so in chapter 6, verse 1, we get this statement. In the 480th year after the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he began to build the house of the Lord. Any thought that the Israelites didn't keep detailed records of their kingdom, or that Israel was not an advanced and developed nation at this time, have to fall before concepts like this. Because in this statement of Scripture, not only do we know that they kept pretty accurate records of the reign of each king, because they know that this is Solomon's fourth year, we know how long David reigned, right? They kept records of that. We know how long Saul reigned. But they apparently had detailed history. 480 years after the people of Israel left Egypt, and they knew it down to the year. What event in Israel's calendar marked a celebration of their leaving Egypt?
Passover.
Every year they come back to Passover, they celebrate the Passover, that's the day God led them out of Egypt. In fact, in Exodus, when God is leading them out for the first time, he says, this is your first month. This is your New Year's month. And on which day of the month do they celebrate Passover? Go ahead, Patricia. It didn't always fall on a Saturday, because it was a number, not a day. Which number of the first month? The 14th day of the month. Passover was always the first month of the year. Now, the Jewish first month of the year is not January. Contrary to popular American opinion, we have not been the center of the world for all of history. Right. We'd like to think so, but we haven't been. Joke with our kids about that, looked at a map and said, there's something wrong with this map. America's not in the center of the world here. We split Asia right down the middle in a lot of maps. How many of you had one of those maps in grade school? Like, America was dead center, and then Asia's cut in half on each side of it right now. That's good old American mentality. We are the center of the world. Go ahead, Eldon. Oh, there you go. Yeah. So, January is not the beginning of their month. Passover roughly coincides with Easter, except our dating of Easter has changed over the centuries, so we don't always date Easter at the same time as the Passover. You know, that was actually a split in the church in the early years. They split over when to celebrate Passover, how to account for the day. Do you go by the date, or do you go by the day? Or there was a really big scuffle about that. See, church splits aren't new either. Okay? They've been happening for a long time. So, but anyway, roughly March, April is going to be your first month of the year. So Solomon's fourth year, it's in the second month, so we're talking about sometime April, maybe May, is when he begins constructing the temple. That makes sense, because the winter months are done. It's time to start building. They don't get as severe winters over there, but still, you can't do a whole lot of building in the winter. So they begin building it, but the 480th year is an extremely important piece of information for us, because it bridges a gap in our information. When we are trying to time out all of the events in the Bible and construct for ourselves a timeline, Eldon, you've done this, right? There are several difficult spots that we have to bridge. Now, the Bible gives us all the information we need, but we got to piece together a few things. And one of those issues is this period that we're given right here. This is a very key text, 480 years. Now, I'm going to put this up there. I don't know why it won't let me rotate it, but hopefully you can at least see this somewhat, okay? You know what? Oh, rats, that's the wrong one. And I only brought one of them over. I thought it was five. I had it open on my tab. I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, I thought it was bad. That's the wrong one, though, because that's starting. Let me use this one. This is my Bible study program, and it's got a pretty decent timeline up here. So you can see the years at the top. Right? Are those fairly readable? The years up there, 1010 BC, 1000. Now remember, as we're in the past, and we are approaching the year zero, we're counting down. Okay? Now we're in the present, we're going farther from the year zero, and so we are moving ahead, counting upwards. But Solomon, well, let's go back here. David, we've studied the life of David, so he begins back here in the middle of the 11th century. I would probably place him just a little farther back so that Solomon's reign actually begins in 1015 AD. So this is a little off from where I'd place it, but this is pretty much where you're going to find most of your study Bibles putting things. Solomon begins sometime right around 1000 BC. We can get more accurate numbers than that because of the data that's given to us in the text. But the only way that we can specifically date him here is by other information that he gives us. So as we're going through the books of Kings, Samuel and Kings, we have been given dating information about how long each king reigned. And that's going to continue, and it's very, very detailed. Some of them reign just a few months. Some of them reign just a few years. Others reign for 50-some years. And so when we piece all that information together, we can get a solid timeline between Solomon and the destruction of the temple. Now, other than that, Solomon, or God through Solomon, did not write down for us and say that Solomon began building the temple in 975 BC. Because they didn't have BC yet back then, right? They date it from the most definitive date in the Israelite nation, which was the Exodus from Egypt. That's what defined them as a people. And so this is 480 years later. Their history's counting up. Imagine us trying to reference a date 1,000 years in the future. Could we do it? No, because we don't know what's going to happen yet, do we? Eldon? You very much can, yep. But there are a couple of things we have to do because the Scripture doesn't give us starting in Genesis and list it all out for us in order. All right, the genealogies of Genesis are really good to get you from creation to the flood to Abraham's life. But how far before the cross is that? You don't know that from Genesis. Then we can date the Exodus. And we know how long it was from, actually, we don't know how long from the Old Testament, how long was it from Abraham to the Exodus. Okay? We have some data there, and they kept really good records. But when you get to trying to place things on our calendar is where you get into the trouble. There are a couple of dates that we know really, really well that help us locate these. And one of them is several hundred years after Solomon, actually not several hundred, 500 years, okay, the destruction of the temple, we can nail down to almost the right date and time, and it's in 586 BC. 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, finally breaches the walls of Jerusalem after a two-year siege, comes in and levels the city. We know that year. So, using the information that God has given us in the books of Kings, Chronicles, and Samuel, we can work backwards from 586 BC. And so we piece together the reigns of all those kings. Now, from 586 BC, working backward to 722 BC, it's not too hard because you've only got one kingdom. You have the southern kingdom of Judah. And what happened in 722 BC? The northern kingdom got carted off to Assyria. So in 722 BC, then, we can start working with both kingdoms. And we can triangulate different dates because they both gave us very good detailed records of how long their kings sat on the throne. So you work your way backwards from the date of the deportation of the northern tribes, 722, and you work your way backwards to when Solomon became king. We know that, and once again, I would put that right about 1015 BC rather than where they put it here at about 975. Okay. About 1015 BC, Solomon becomes king. 4 years into that, then, he builds the temple, or begins building the temple in his fourth year. So it's actually 3 years after it. So we can add 3 years to his reign. That gets us to about 1012 BC, 1012 years before Christ. Solomon begins building the temple. And this verse tells us that that event happened 480 years after the people of Israel came out of Egypt. So now we can jump back from Solomon's reign and we can springboard 480 years back to the Exodus. Well, we know what happened after the Exodus. How long did it take the people of Israel to get to the land of Canaan? It took 40 years. They wandered around because of their unbelief. So they spend about a year and a half down on Mount Sinai, over in Midian, right? Not in Sinai. And Eldon's got some. I agree with you completely, but that the traditional site for Mount Sinai is misplaced. But that's a whole other topic. So you go back the 480 years to the Exodus. Now you have 40 years until they actually enter the land. It takes them about 7 years to conquer the land. Then you have the period of the judges. How long does that last, and how do you know? Well, if you add up, if you just take the dates given in Judges and you add them all up, it's too long. There was actually there's some overlap going on in there, right? So the period of the judges is a difficult section to try and get our chronology down, and this date of 480 years fixes our limits for us. So Solomon begins building the temple in the fourth year of his reign. We have 40 years wandering in the desert on this end. So there's 40. We got 3 years of Solomon's reign before that. How many years did David reign before Solomon became king? It's 40. So we back that up another 40. Well, that's 83 years now that we've got accounted for. Now, how long was Saul king before David became king? Also 40. Now we're up to 123 years that we can take off of that 480, which leaves us 360 years for the period of the judges, the book of Judges, from the time Joshua enters the land until the time Saul becomes king. That accounts for the life of Samuel, the life of Samson, all the judges in between, and the end of Joshua's life. We've got 360 years there to deal with, okay? So that gives us some limits to place things on. And from the Exodus to Egypt, if we can nail down that date as being right around 1490, somewhere around 1495 BC is the Exodus. Then you can springboard backwards, because we know how long Israel was in Egypt. We know the timing between the Exodus and Abraham. And then from Abraham, you can work all the way backwards to the creation, given the genealogies in Genesis. So God does give us history from the very beginning of the world all the way up till now. We can account for our history. In my mind, that's a pretty amazing thing, because most of us walk around. How many of you have seen Ancestry.com commercials? All right. Anybody ever done it? Sent in a blood sample and gotten your DNA test? No? I haven't either. But Dan, you've traced your history way, way back to the third century? To 250. That's pretty good. Okay. People walk around feeling very disconnected because they don't know who they are. They don't know where they came from. And they think that answering the question of their genealogy is going to help them define who they are. So that if I am 30% German and 70% Irish, well, that helps me know who I am. I must be Irish. That's why I like potatoes. Right? Yeah, Germans like potatoes too. And frankly, we know we got potatoes from the Native Americans. So before 1492, what did the Irish eat? Who knows? Maybe it was a different thing. I don't know. Fish. There you go. Yeah. So, but if I can trace my lineage back to Ireland, okay, maybe that helps me understand understand me a little bit, right? We know every nation's got their own little idiosyncrasies to them. Reading a history book of Ireland one time, talking about William Wallace. And William Wallace went over to Ireland to ask for their help, you know, freeing Scotland from England. And he talked to the Scottish leader, and the Scottish leader said, "I don't think we can help you because the Irish are brave, like you Scots are, but we don't have any endurance. If we lose the first battle, they'll all go home." And he understood his people well enough to say they weren't nearly as stubborn as the Scottish people were at that time. And I said, "Huh, that explains Irish an awful lot, doesn't it?" Short-fused and impatient. Huh, I get it. So you know, every nation sort of has these little character traits that sort of go along with them. So that can help you understand things a little bit, but what do you do if you try to push back farther than that? What is it that really defines us as people? Who am I? Who are we? How far back do you have to go before you really understand who you are? Now, from an evolutionary point of view, you can't take that back that far, can you? Because you'll find some monkey in Africa. But from a biblical point of view, we can trace all of our connections back to Adam. And Luke does it with the Lord Jesus. Because of the information that the Israelites kept in the books of Chronicles, Kings, and Samuel, and the information that they kept in their own personal records later on, this connection was extremely important to them to be able to say, "I want to understand how I connect back to the beginning." Because ultimately, we are all born as sons of Adam. What does that mean? What characteristics does that carry for us? How does being a son of Adam influence me? It means I'm fallen. It means I'm a sinner. It means I'm a rebel right alongside Adam, my dad. Remember what I said this morning? I am my father's son. That is true of every one of us, and we're all sons of Adam. We're all daughters of Eve. You're going to say something, Eldon? That's right. So this verse, it's short, but it gives us this very important information that connects everything. We heard some testimonies of some missionaries to Papua New Guinea. And, you know, for most Americans, you get to the genealogies and Chronicles, and we just, "Oh, I'm going to sleep. This is boring. I'm skipping, you know, my devotions." I'm like, okay. Got it. Page after page. 10 chapters of this stuff. We skip it because to us it's uninteresting, unimportant. When they got to the genealogies in Genesis chapter 6 through 9 with the Potpatar people in Papua New Guinea, they said, "I saw everybody's eyes light up," and they said, "These aren't stories. This is real. This is history. This isn't made up." And missionaries were able to make that connection for those people. This is real. You are descended from Adam through a distant line of people. All right. So God has given us these little connections in here to let us know these accounts are not made up. This is real history that we're reading about. So, 480th year. That was a long walk off a short pier. Right. Verse 2. "The house that King Solomon built for the Lord was 60 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, 30 cubits high." How long is a cubit? About 18 inches. All right. About 18 inches. It did vary. Depending on, there was an old cubit before Babylon. There's a new cubit after Babylon. The book of Chronicles tells us that we're specifically dealing with the old cubit, which was right around 18 inches. Okay? It's the dimensions that he's given us for us. 60 cubits long translates to 90 feet long. I should have marked this off. How long, anybody know how long is our auditorium? We've got to be probably about 50 feet in here. So you've got to go back a little bit farther. It's 90 feet long, it's 30 feet wide, and it's 45 feet high. That's tall. This thing is definitely narrow, long, and very, very tall, rather than short and squat. I did pull up for you a couple of fun pictures. Now, mind you, these are not definitive. These are artists' reconstructions, so it's not absolutely the way it looked, but some of these do a pretty good job of taking into account the biblical data. So there's one with a cross-section taken out of it. There is a mock-up of what it may look like. Now, I'll actually tell you, I don't think this one's all that accurate, because look at how deep that building is. That doesn't look like it's 90 feet long, does it? The main structure, anyway. This right here should be about 90 feet long. Now, maybe they're taking the 90 feet as the length of the whole thing, but I don't think that's what the text is describing for us. Okay, this is the temple, and so that probably should be much longer. So I kind of like this picture better. 90 feet this way, we are 20 cubits this way across, and 45 cubits tall. The vestibule, verse 3, the vestibule in front of the nave of the house was 20 cubits long, equal to the width of the house, and 10 cubits deep in front of the house. Now, he's describing this structure on the front. So, this taller tower-looking thing, now they've cut off half of it here so you can see inside it, stretched the same width as the rest of the house, but it was 10 cubits this way and taller on the front. And so this is where the main doors are going to be. It's sort of like a front porch for the temple. Eventually, we're going to read the description that this is where Solomon placed these two giant bronze pillars. And as accurate as Solomon was in recording for us everything that was used, he said these were too heavy to bother weighing. They were massive, these bronze pillars. Okay, so that's sort of the porch of the house. Verse 4, he made for the house windows with recessed frames. This picture accounts for those here in the top. You probably a little hard to see them, but right there are some windows along the upper portion of the sanctuary inside. And so this the temple had some windows in it. He built also, verse 5, a structure against the wall of the house, running around the walls of the house, both the nave and the inner sanctuary, and he made side chambers all around. That is talking about some storage rooms on the outside, which are depicted here. Once again, most of them have been cut away for so that you can see what's going on there. But all along the side of the temple, there would have been these storage rooms. Because obviously, people are bringing in their offerings. And before the days of standardized currency, you didn't just bring in money as your offering. You brought in a tenth of the produce of your land. And so, one out of every 10 eggs, you take to the temple, right? One out of every 10 chickens that was hatched, you take to the temple. One out of 10 bushels that you raised, that went to the temple. What are they going to do with all that? They have to store it somewhere. They use it for making the meal offerings. They use it for feeding the priests. They would sell some of it for upkeep on the temple, all right? They had a lot of different uses, so they had to keep all these things, and they had storerooms all along the sides of the temple. Well, he tells us that the lowest story, or there's three stories there, which you can see fairly well in this picture. But as they go up, they get a little bit bigger. And the reason for that is the temple most likely stepped as it went up. That's not real clear on our picture here. But listen to how he describes this in verse 6. The lowest story was 5 cubits broad, so that's 7.5 feet. It's a room, 7.5 feet wide. The middle was 6 cubits, or 9 feet, and the third was 7 cubits, or about a little over 10 feet. For around the outside of the house, he made offsets on the wall in order that the supporting beams should not be inserted into the walls of the house. So the house itself is the temple proper, and that would come up and step in just a little bit. The stones would get narrower, because we know the stones that formed the walls were massive. Very thick. You know, we build our exterior walls mostly out of 2x6s. That gives us enough insulation to put in there, gives us enough strength to hold up the building. They didn't make a wall that was only 6 or 8 inches thick. They made a wall that was 2 or 3 feet thick. Very, very strong, very, very heavy. And so the wall would get a little bit thinner as it went up, and each step would be then a little bit lighter. That was to help reduce the load on the lowest levels. But it also created a little bit of a step pattern as the temple went up. So if you're stepping on the outside, then you have a little bit wider of a space every so often as you go up. So that's why the rooms would get a little bit bigger as they met the wall of the temple. But he did that specifically so that the storerooms would not actually be a part of the temple. He could use that as support without joining them to that wall. Verse 7, when the house was built, it was with stone prepared at the quarry, so that neither hammer nor axe nor any tool of iron was heard in the house while it was being built. Anybody ever live next to a construction site? House is being built? It's noisy. It's very loud, especially today with all the power tools and things. So, Cynthia, are they going to have all the units built before you guys move in? Oh, wow. Okay. So you're not going to have to hear too much construction going on over there then. Okay. Makes a lot of noise, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, they go driving nails all at 6 in the morning and, yep, turn on their air compressors and brrr. Especially when they're digging foundations and they got all that heavy equipment in there. Well, it's not that there was no construction noise going on, but when they quarried the stone, they cut it straight out of the earth, and they would quarry it in such a way that when it broke off of the main piece of bedrock, it was already the right shape and size. Amazing technology, however they did this. We know that the Egyptians were really good at this because when you look at the pyramids, you say, you can't fit a piece of paper between the rocks. They're fit that tight. How did they do that? Well, one way is after you break the rock off of the bedrock, you shave it using axes and other cutting tools. But specifically tells us here that Solomon didn't want to use cutting tools on it. Probably because back in Exodus and in Deuteronomy, most of you probably have a note on this, God tells them that if you're going to build an altar, don't use your stone or don't use your tool upon it, or you'll defile it. Right? And so Solomon might be following that. We're not specifically told why he does it this way, but when he breaks the thing off of the bedrock, it's already the right shape and the right size. Now the way they would do this is if you have a big flat spot of rock. You would dig a channel down, you measure out how wide you want this rock and how deep you want it, and you dig a channel down on one side, and you dig under it just a little bit, and you would stick wood in there that was cut to fit in pretty snugly, and then you start dumping water down in there. And what happens to wood when it soaks up a lot of water? It expands, and it would expand enough and create pressure and break that rock right off of the bedrock, and then you could take it and haul it to where you needed it. Now, you know, we still have no idea how the Egyptians hauled the stones for the pyramids. We can speculate, but we really don't know how they moved those things. They're huge, and they didn't have big cranes and bulldozers and things. We're not really sure how they moved the stones for the temple, because we're going to see in further descriptions here, some of these stones were huge. I mean, they were massive stones, but he cuts them at the quarry, and then takes them to the house where they can be used. Incidentally, there is a quarry right under Jerusalem today. I've been down in it. They call it Solomon's Quarry, but it's actually not. You have to be careful when you go over there, because they will try to tell you that everything that exists in Israel has a biblical significance when most of it's been manufactured at a factory down the street and sold to you. Right. So, although I knew of a guy that went over there and he was in Jericho, and they let him go down into an excavation site that was being newly excavated, and the guy kind of poked at a wall and a rock fell out and this old pottery came out. He took it home. He said he snuck it home because it looks just like the souvenir stuff they sell in the shops and things, but this one was actually probably a 3,000 year old piece of pottery that he got a hold of. So hopefully nobody catches up with him after I said that, but hey, there it is. So, what was I going? Oh, the quarry that's there is there, but it was used to build Herod's temple. So, Solomon builds his temple right about 1000 BC, 1012, and it lasts until 586 BC when it's destroyed by the Babylonians. And then 70 years later, some of the exiles come home to Israel, and they start building another one. That temple, Ezra's temple, stays constructed until Herod the Great comes on the scene about 30 BC. And so Herod the Great then begins this huge renovation of the exiles' temple. And that's what we call Herod's temple. That's the temple that exists in Jesus' day. Herod is the one who commissioned the digging of this huge quarry underneath of Jerusalem. But when the house was built, I just read that, verse 8, the entrance for the lowest story was on the south side of the house, and one went up by stairs to the middle story, and from the middle story to the third. So he built the house and finished it, and made the ceiling of the house of beams and planks of cedar. He built the structure against the whole house, 5 cubits high, and it was joined to the house with timbers of cedar. So this is sort of a description of the roof. Well, you have these stone walls going up. What are you going to use for the roof? You can't just stack stone across. It'll fall in. So you have to use big cedar timbers. Well, remember when he signed a treaty with Hiram, king of Tyre, to bring all the wood down? Here's where the wood comes into play. They need it for structural support, so they're going to make a wooden roof out of everything, over top of the temple proper and over top of the storerooms on the side. So verse 11, now the word of the Lord came to Solomon and said, concerning this house that you are building, if you will walk in my statutes and obey my rules and keep all my commandments and walk in them, then I will establish my word with you, which I spoke to David your father, and I will dwell among the children of Israel, and I will not forsake my people Israel. Here's this great promise from God. You keep my law, and I'll keep you. How did this work out in history? Did Solomon keep God's word? No, he didn't. Did Israel keep God's law? No, they didn't. Did God forsake his people? Temporarily, yes. He kicked them out of the land. Ultimately, no. So remember, there are two different senses of forsaking. Right? God temporarily did kick his people out of the land, but that does not mean he completely abandoned them. And in fact, in one instance, he uses the word, I divorce you, get out of my house. And he sends Israel away. Gives her her certificate of divorce because she's been unfaithful to him. And so as Solomon is building this temple, God is letting Solomon know that just the presence of this temple does not guarantee the favor of God. Why? Remember the distinction we talked about last time. Why did the heathen nations build a temple? To minister to the needs of their God so that he could be strong and take care of them. Is there any sense of that with Solomon's temple? Does God need his need? Does God have needs that we're supposed to minister to gain his favor? Not in any sense of the word. So God is sending this message to Solomon. Don't think for a moment that just because you're building this house, that automatically guarantees that I am favorable towards you. If you obey me, I'll bless you. If you disobey me, I'll kick you out. The terms of God's covenant with his people still stand, even once this temple is built. And we'll see how that works out over the centuries. Any questions?